alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Theology is far too important to get from a cartoon, but sadly, that's what many young Americans are doing. Welcome to The Bunker. This is A View from The Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert, where we do our best to talk the walk, and tonight we're going to talk about pop culture and the influence of cartoons, comics, specifically coming from Japan and influencing young people here in America. Our guest tonight is a social critic. He was a host for quite some time of the let's call it the podcast on hiatus, Snark Infested Waters, online at thesnarkyavenger.com. Our good friend Taylor Kent joins us tonight. Taylor, it's good to talk to you again. We just saw you and your wife in Colorado Springs here just a couple of weeks ago, but it had been too long before that we had actually spoken and talked face to face.
Yeah, no, I agree. It was great to see you guys, and it's great to be on the show again. It's been a while.
Gosh, yeah. Last time we were, it was the house on Broadway in Shelbyville, which puts this in about 2008, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And we attended a Christian horror conference in Indianapolis, which was interesting in and of itself. You had a really good suggestion out in Colorado Springs, and that's the reason for this program. One of my talks out there was on the topic of transhumanism, which is something I'm feeling very strongly about because I see the appeal to people who aren't grounded, especially in Bible prophecy. I mean, if you don't understand where God says humanity is going and why we are going in that direction, so maybe I guess it's the beginning of the Bible and the end of the Bible, you're open to all kinds of alternate future possibilities. As Christians, we know Jesus is going to come back ultimately. If he tarries, then those of us who fall asleep, to use the phrase Paul used, we'll join him, you know, first. But ultimately, we know the end of history is Jesus comes back at the head of a heavenly host, defeats the Antichrist, the false prophet, throws them along with death and hell into the lake of fire, and then we go on to live in the New Jerusalem. But if you don't buy into Bible prophecy, if you allegorize it, or if you just reject the Bible altogether, there are all kinds of different possibilities open to you. And that's where transhumanism has its appeal, especially in our scientistic culture in the West.
Right.
And you mentioned that a very popular form of entertainment for young people, anime, Japanese style of animation, is really pushing this idea. So there hunts the program tonight. Describe anime and what makes it different, unique from, say, the Warner Brothers or Walt Disney cartoons that our generation grew up with.
Okay, so anime is basically the Japanese word for animation. And it runs in conjunction with manga, which is the Japanese word for comic books. And the history, as I understand it, is that after World War II, you know, the GIs who were still in Japan had American comic books and had American movies and especially Disney movies and stuff. And the people there were really impressed with it. And they wanted to emulate that to some degree. But they put their own spin on it. Obviously, they have their own history and culture to go with it. And they started producing their own comic books. And then eventually, I think sometime in the 60s, we started seeing actual animated movies and animated television shows. And I'm not an expert on that history there, but that's when, you know, we started getting some of the, you started seeing the leanings of how things were going over there. Because as a country, after the war, they were devastated. And a lot of what brought them out of that devastation was good industrial production and scientific advancements. So they were building awesome electronic stuff long before a lot of other countries were. And mm-hmm. they would just get ahead of everybody else. So in a lot of ways, now, I believe it's still classified as a Shinto country, Japan is. And if you know anything about Shinto, Shinto has about a million gods. There's a god for everything. that exist. You can, if there's a situation you're in, you'll find a god for it somewhere. And they have shrines all over the place to it. There's also a large influence of Buddhism. And as I understand it, there is some Christianity, but I don't know how big the influence is. You don't see a lot of that influence in their media, at least in the stuff I've seen. What you usually see, and this started back in the 60s, is that science is the savior.
Mm.
The first big show that came over to the United States, and it was one of the first giant robot shows that was shown in, or that was ever made, was called Gigantor here, and I don't remember, it's like Tetsuo something, there's a number after it, in Japan, and it was the idea, you know, that was kind of their first big, science is our hero, a giant robot will go and fight and defeat the bad guys and save us, and how did we get the giant robot? Well, science built it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And admittingly, in some of the giant robot stuff, they actually fight supernatural monsters and all that kind of thing. But usually it's always, well, science is saving us in some way. And I was really into anime for a while, and I kind of got out of it for a while, and I've gotten back into it. And it started, you know, now that I'm more aware of the whole transhumanism thing, I started seeing a lot more parallels. And looking back, it's pretty obvious they were always there to some degree. In almost, and you have that here too, but it's a little more pronounced there. You always have kind of the idea, at least in their more science fiction-y and horror, of someone being enhanced in some way to save everybody else. We have that in our own comic books and movies. If you look at, you know, the superhero movies and stuff. One of the things that I think appeals, a lot of people really like the art style, and that's somewhat varied based on the different artists, but coming from a culture that is, how do I want to put this, is very knowledge-centric. They still believe in education. They still believe that knowledge is good, that learning is good. You know, if you don't make it past high school, you're kind of a nobody in their culture. They have to cater their entertainment to a smarter audience.
Hmm.
So unlike a lot of American television that really is aimed at the fifth grade level or
lowest
lower,
common denominator, yeah.
Yeah.
Precursor to the Idiocracy.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Their lowest common denominator is higher. So people, you know, and I can say this for myself, I don't feel that my intelligence is being insulted nearly as much when I watch some of these shows because they actually explore some interesting ideas. And this wasn't a show I was going to mention, but it kind of points out some of the things they do. There's a show called Gunbuster, and it's a science fiction thing. Giant robots fight off at a space alien. But the thing that made that one unique for the time, and that one was made, I want to say, the late 70s, early 80s. And in it, they actually explore the concept of time dilation.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, the idea that, well, we're traveling at the speed of light to be able to intercept these things. So what happens? And they get into, well, they came back, but they're 5 years ahead, or everybody else is 5 years ahead of them. So all this stuff has gone on, you know, and we don't, have you seen that in much America, maybe in some books, but you don't see that on TV or in movies.
No, the only thing that comes close is a novel I read by the science fiction author Joe Haldeman called The Forever War.
Yep.
Where guys go off to war, and because they're fighting so much of their battles or traveling between battles at light speed, by the time they get back home, everyone that they've known is gone. And
right.
And society has changed way beyond their ability to adapt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And Gunbuster explores that at the end when they come back and it's 3,000 years in the future.
Right, yeah.
You know, but when I started getting back into this and I started watching shows, the first show I kind of stumbled upon that I really enjoyed, it was really good storytelling, was a show called Psychopass. And for those of you who are listening, you're probably going to get some spoilers if you want to go check this out. This show happened to recently drop on Netflix. There are really two major places to get anime in the United States right now online. There are two really legal sources.
Mm-hmm.
Funimation has a streaming service that I've subscribed to, and Crunchyroll has a streaming service that I subscribe to. And because of that, and some other interesting things, the pervasivity of what's available to people is amazing. It used to be, back when I first got into this, you would wait years before a show you might have heard about gets brought to America. Now they do simulcasting of shows. So literally the show will be aired in Japan and 5 hours later it'll be online in America for people to watch.
So the popularity of anime has really grown over time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and now that I think about it, the 1960s cartoon series Speed Racer,
yep,
was an early example of anime, and that's, yep, got kind of that anime style with the, you know, the really big eyes and
yep,
yeah, so forth. But not quite the transhuman idea that we're exploring here tonight. How? And we've seen this similar sort of virtual simulcast thing happening with some British shows here recently. Mm-hmm. Doctor Who has gotten to the point where it's when it airs on BBC in the UK, and then the same night it will air on BBC America here in the United States. But the Japanese animation, I mean, you know, again, I was just a little too old to really catch that wave when it came over. Mm-hmm. But I can see in my own family, my daughter is gifted artistically, a gift that skipped me, went from my dad to her. And her style has been very much influenced by anime. When I look at the characters that she draws, cartoon characters or just characters out of her own head or what have you, or characters that she's emulating from things that she's watching on TV, clearly she is drawing from anime because it has a distinctive style.
Right.
How influential is it? I mean, you know, again, the only thing I can draw on is what I see from my daughter, but I know she's kind of weird, so I'm not sure I can draw conclusions from her.
I'm fairly
weird in a good way.
Yeah, go ahead.
Weird in a good way. She gets Doctor Who and Monty Python, so she's okay.
Nothing wrong with either of those.
Right.
The anime community, and I'm fairly involved in the fandom here in the Twin Cities. I'm staff on two conventions, so yeah, I'm fairly involved. But on one of those conventions, I work in the art department, and there are tons of people, artists, who emulate this style. And I think we do what's called an artist alley at Anime Detour, which is the convention I work art in. And we had a fairly large room filled with tables with artists at it who were all – I mean, they're technically not supposed to be selling their stuff because it's all fan art and stuff. But they were all doing anime-style stuff, and they were selling their stuff. And there had to be 80 or 100 artists in there. And that's just at one convention. And there's lots of people who've been influenced by this. You know, there's, you know, for every person, it's a little different, but you know, there's a lot of things that, one of the things that I think appeals to a lot of people in anime is that anime culture or the fandom culture is very inclusive. Unlike a lot of science fiction and fantasy culture, where if you're not into what I'm into, then you're wrong.
Oh, okay.
You know, when you get into the fights over Star Trek versus Star Wars.
Right, yeah.
And they get down and dirty sometimes.
Yeah. Of course, the answer to that question is Doctor Who. So it's subtle.
Yeah, that's true, obviously.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I found in the anime community is they are far more accepting of people of faith. Whereas in the science fiction fantasy community, they tend to think you're an idiot if you believe in anything other than science or atheism or something like that.
Well, you anticipated my question there, because that's been a real fight that's been taking place in the science fiction community, specifically among the science fiction writers of America,
mm-hmm,
which expelled an author by the name of Theodore Beale. He writes under the pseudonym Vox Dei, who, uh-huh, is a very open Christian. Some might call him an obnoxious Christian. He's a very intelligent guy and has a little bit of intellectual pride, and he doesn't mind picking a fight.
Uh-huh.
And he got himself kicked out of the SFWA for expressing some of his views. But by so doing, some other authors have come around and kind of rallied around him. They're kind of dubbed themselves now the Evil League of Evil. And one of them, at least one of them in particular, John C. Wright, is a very open Christian as well. And they have really pointed out the very dark underbelly, if you will, of the core of the science fiction writers community in the United States anyway. And it's not just about writing stories anymore. It's about pushing a specific agenda.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, anyway, you anticipated my question because I was going to ask about the differences between that community and the anime community.
Yeah, the anime community tends to be a lot more open to that stuff. And I think that's just because anime is a medium. It's not a genre. You've got shows from everywhere, from slice of life to high school dramas to, you know, horror to science fiction. There's stuff all over the place. And they're all pretty popular. I don't happen to be into their slice of life and their high school drama shows, but I know people who are. And a lot of that appeals, so a lot of those appeal more, and their comedies appeal more to the younger people. But they also have really good science fiction shows and really good horror shows. So, you know, but because it is that, it's a medium, you know, I think people are more like, well, you like anime and I like anime. We can deal with each other. Sure, you get people talking about what's better and what shows are better and all that kind of stuff, but I've never seen it devolve into a fist fight like I have at a science fiction convention.
Wow.
So, you know, it can be pretty wild.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, though, the fact that the style, the medium, originates in a country that is predominantly Shinto and it just has a very, very small Christian community, when you get into supernatural themes, how does that manifest in the storylines?
In most of the supernatural stuff, it's very, I don't want to say it's very Shinto because that isn't always the case, but it's rare that you find a case where people are asking for help from God. Magic is generally okay. The heroes will often use magic to defeat their enemies. With exceptions, you know, those kind of things. And obviously the mythology and stuff usually leans more towards the Japanese mythology. So you get the weird spider monsters that can change their shape to lure people in, and, or spider demons and ogres and things like that. Hmm. But generally speaking, the theological position is more that it's almost humanist in the sense that man can defeat these things oftentimes, but you have to use extraordinary means to do it.
Okay, and that's where the science and the orientation towards science and knowledge comes in.
A lot of times, yeah. I mean, there are exceptions to everything. I'll come back to the show Psychopaths that I mentioned, but there's a show that a friend of mine talked me into looking at called Claymore. And the idea of it, it's set more in it's kind of a medieval Japan, but it's a fantasy setting. The idea is there are these demons that are running around and they kill people and they destroy towns and they're evil. But they often rape women as they're doing this, and they create offspring. And there's an organization that's come who use these offspring who have managed to gain control of their demon side to go kill the demons, because regular people can't do it. You know, that's one of the potential. So then you've got the idea that, well, the hero is more than human or not human.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the case. There's usually some kind of augmentation involved with the hero. And there are exceptions to that, but generally speaking, the heroes of the story, even the villains in some cases, are augmented in some way, whether it be through science or magic or blessing of a deity of some kind. You do have a fair amount of stories such as Death Note and Future Diaries where it's God's meddling in earthly business.
Mm-hmm.
So Death Note, which I have not seen the whole series, is a death god, quote unquote. I don't remember the Japanese term. Leaves this book that's his death note, which is a kind of a diary or a journal. And a school kid finds it. And there's some instructions in the front that says, basically, if you write somebody's name in this, they'll die within 30 seconds. There's some rules about it. And at first he doesn't want anything to do with it. And then he's tempted by the power, right?
Sure.
And at least the initial storyline is this kid decides to use it for, quote, good. So he's going to get rid of all the bad people. But shortly into that, you find that, oh, look, the Death God's getting something out of you doing this, whether it's for the good people or the bad people, and he's happy with what you're doing. So you got to question what's going on there. You know, it's a kind of a devil's tempting you to do something really bad kind mm-hmm. of thing. So,
and tempting you to rationalizing it as something good.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. And it's the toying with humanity idea too. You know, this is just entertainment for this creature. Oh, I'll leave it out and see what happens. Oh, well, that's not very nice of you, kind of thing.
It's in a way similar to the approach to the supernatural that Stephen King takes.
Mm-hmm.
God and the devil will occasionally play roles in Stephen King's storylines. The Stand, in particular, is one that people may be familiar with. But God is sort of a distant, barely interested player who seems to be just playing a game of chess with humanity, with Satan, just because.
Right.
And there doesn't appear to be any rhyme or reason for it. Which is a real twist on the Christian method or message, the message of Christ and salvation. There's no end game. It's just a power game between God and Satan. And because it's clear that God can defeat Satan anytime he chooses, as you know, you see at the end of The Stand, you have to wonder, what's the point of this then? What's the point of all the suffering that was just inflicted upon humanity? Because during the course of The Stand, what, about 95% of humanity is wiped out or something like that?
Right.
Yeah. For what purpose? For what purpose? None. Anyway, I don't want to riff on Stephen King. That's not the point of the program here tonight. Right. But anyway.
But it is similar. It's a lot of at least some of the theological stuff is like that. It's, oh, I'm bored. I'm going to go mess with humanity for a while, you know, and that's not all of it. You get other things too. A lot of the horror, I guess about half and half is actually more period historical pieces. So there's a lot of fighting weird spider demons and stuff like that. But then you get into like ninjas and samurais, and you get into the weird codes that are in that too. And, you know, there really wasn't a strong Christian influence in those times, at least not until the Portuguese really started making inroads into Japan. So, and over there, they just add, it's like a lot of religions. They just go, oh, well, we'll just add Jesus Christ to our pantheon. We're good.
Yeah. He's just one more in the, one more that we got to worship and appease just in case he gets mad.
Right.
Well, What's the appeal of this art form to young adults and teens here in the United States? I mean, there are some real cultural differences from Japan to the United States, and I would have to assume that it would take more than just dubbing the dialogue into English to make it resonate.
Well, and a lot of, when it first started coming over, we didn't even have a lot of dubbing. It was all subtitles. I think some of it is definitely escapism. When you're watching something that's from another country, it's that much bigger a level of escape. These aren't Americans. They aren't doing American things. It's different. There's an appeal to that difference. There's a lot of, fantasy. I think people have some fantasies about, well, what would it be like if I lived in Japan and went to high school in Japan, because their structure in schools and that stuff is very different than here.
Mm-hmm.
I think the art in and of itself, I think animation appeals a lot to younger people. And I think some of that is the influence of computers and video games and other things, because we are inundated, especially young people, with a lot more animation than, say, when you and I grew up. You know, we had, there were a few things on TV. You know, we had Tom and Jerry, and there were actually a couple of Japanese cartoons that had been dubbed that I got to watch growing up, like Mazinger Z and Speed Racer.
Right.
But cartoons were kids' stuff. And you Bugs Bunny and all that. In Japan, cartoons are for all ages. They have stuff for everybody. They have a lot more live action than they used to, but that still isn't the primary medium.
Really?
Yeah. They didn't, you know, when they got started, it was cheaper to do animation. You got lots of people than it is to do live action. Huh. So, and to be honest, the live action I've watched isn't anywhere near as good as their animated stuff.
No. So. Well, Japanese live action would be things like, what, the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and stuff like
well,
that?
Well, yeah, there's all the Sentai Team stuff. So since I just threw the term out, I should explain it. Sentai Team, I believe, is a team of five, like, superhero-type guys, like Power Rangers, who have ninja-like powers. And they go out and they fight monsters and fight villains and do all that kind of stuff. There are a lot of examples of them. But they have a lot of just drama stuff, too. I mean, just like we would have.
Mm-hmm.
They have soap operas. They have soap operas in anime, and they have soap operas in live action, just like we would have.
Huh.
You know, in fact, soap operas do better there than they do here. And they may call them something else. But and their genres are split up differently. And I don't know how much this applies to transhumanism, but it's good information to have. Rather than having, you know, we have our genres kind of split up as horror, science fiction, fantasy, drama, comedy, other, I don't know, there's other ones, right? Over there you have those genres, but you also have the concept of shonen and shoujo. So shonen, which I might be butchering the pronunciation of, basically means for boys.
Hmm.
And that when you look at a show that's shonen, you pretty much know it's shonen if the main character is a adolescent boy. And then they have the concept of shoujo, which is for girls. So then it's an adolescent girl.
Okay.
So they split things up also across gender lines to some degree too. There's still a lot that doesn't fall in that. There's also a genre whose name I cannot think of that means more mature or for adults. And then there's, of course, the genres everybody knows about that make Japan look bad, like all of their pornographic genres.
Yeah.
But we don't, you know, honestly, you have to look for that stuff if you're interested. It isn't mainstream here. So,
but,
and that's good.
Manga and anime, you know, have found an audience here. What are some of the common themes that in some of the more popular programs? What are the elements that if you looked at a number of these, you could pick out and say, okay, this is a recurring theme that appears in anime?
Magical girls, which is the idea. It's Sailor Moon, basically. It's the idea of it's kind of a Sentai Team thing in some cases, and it's not. But it's girls who transform into, like, superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Sailor Moon is probably the definitive example. There's a lot of other ones out there. I don't happen to be a big fan of it, so I don't watch them.
Interestingly enough, just to enter, I was in a small town in southern Illinois yesterday, and I saw a beat-up pickup truck, you know, the kind of thing that you see a lot of in rural areas here in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. With a license plate on it that said SLRMOON.
Oh, yeah. Sailor Moon has been around a long time. It was brought over and shown on television here. It was very popular. It's still I have friends who, at a convention that was here recently, it wasn't an anime convention, some people I know actually stayed up till 5 a.m. to watch the premiere in simulcast of the new Sailor Moon series they're doing. And the room was packed at 5 a.m.
Wow.
To watch this.
Wow.
You know, it's a very popular genre. Some of the other things you'll find is a lot of science-y things. Science is often the hero, or science leads to the hero. Not in all cases, but in a lot of cases. Use of magic is pretty common. In fact, there are a lot of shows like about high schools that teach you magic, or things like that, or some weird cross. There's a show, a friend of mine was trying to talk me into it. I watched one episode and said, no, this isn't my thing, but it's now I got to look up the name. Strike Witches.
Hmm.
It's set during World War II, I believe. It's actually set in Europe, and basically there are these girls who have magic powers who've been given these suits that allow them to fly. So they go and they defend England. You know, frankly, it's a show filled with a lot of fan service, which I'll explain in a minute.
Okay.
And the storyline actually is fairly interesting, but there's enough other stuff that makes it – I just don't want to watch it. Fan service is the idea that – or is basically where they're trying to appeal to the audience lewdly. So you'll see a girl's skirt blow up and see her panties.
Gotcha.
Things like that. Some shows are really heavy on that. Some aren't. Some start out heavy on that, and then it fades away.
Once they develop the audience.
Right. Yeah. Or they develop their start developing their characters more. It's interesting because there are a few shows I started watching and I'm like, oh, this is going to be bad. And the next episode, there's nothing. And it's just a good story. It's like, well, what was – I guess you were just planting the hook there to get everybody to watch the show. So, yeah. But there are shows that is considered a genre for, and it's like, really? But it's popular. trying to think of what are some of the other major themes.
So magical girls, science.
Robots are really popular right now. People who, you know, robots who are characters using robots for things, even as much as robot characters in high school dramas in some cases. aliens to some degree. And it's interesting because, you know, here more and more we kind of have leaned in some ways towards the good aliens helping us kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Over there, it's still a really mixed bag, and oftentimes the aliens are the villains. But there are examples of shows where aliens go to high school with everybody else. It's just normal. You know? So, and you know, these aren't 100% pervasive, but they're there. A lot of these themes are there. There's almost always some kind of love triangle or some kind of love story mixed in to the most of the shows of some kind. Depending on the type of show, that might have sexual repercussions, but usually it doesn't for a lot of the shows. Yeah, those are the big ones. Violence is the other thing you'll find a lot of.
Yeah, well, we had that in Tom and Jerry too. So
right.
The influence of anime, one of the things that struck me about this and the reason I opened the show the way I did is that after the release of The Da Vinci Code, did some reading on why people were so receptive to a message that most of us who had read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which really developed the theology that Dan Brown appropriated for The Da Vinci Code, the idea that, you know, Jesus didn't really die on the cross, that didn't really explain all that, but somehow he survived one way or another. And he and Mary Magdalene went off to the south of France where they got married and had kids and gave birth to the plot for the Da Vinci Code, I guess.
Right.
And apparently there is a phenomenon that we are subject to when we view a story, and we are drawn into the characters, we begin to identify with the characters is what I meant. And somewhere our filter that screens for baloney just is put on hold. And we're somehow then open to ideas that we would reject if we were reading a book that was allegedly nonfiction or watching a documentary film. Because we're reading a work of fiction or seeing a film, somehow we're open to the idea that maybe the Holy Grail really is buried in Paris, or that Rosalind Chapel in Scotland has something to do with the Holy Grail. And suddenly, you know, the Da Vinci Code sells millions of copies and Rosalind Chapel is overrun by tourists who are really – or, you know, really extreme example, the case in up your neck of the woods, the a girl from Japan who flew to the United States and in the middle of winter went out looking for that case full of money from the movie Fargo, because she was convinced it was buried somewhere on a highway, and she thought she'd figured it out, and she wound up freezing to death, literally freezing to death, looking for that case. You know, the fact that there was this little disclaimer at the end of the film saying this is a work of fiction and all characters, any similarity to characters real or is purely coincidental, just kind of blew right past her BS filter.
Right.
So how are some of these messages from anime getting past those filters in fans of the style, and how is it manifesting? And do you have any thoughts on where that is leading a generation of fans of anime in how they view the world?
Okay. I think one of the things that appeals, and you'll find there are a lot of women who enjoy anime, which isn't is you don't find as many, or you didn't used to find as many in science fiction and fantasy fandom.
Right.
And part of that is because anime has a lot of strong female characters. They don't really restrict their heroes to men. We get a lot more strong male characters, and that's changed a bit. But generally speaking, there's a lot more of a mix in Japan with your strong characters. So that appeals to more women. I think some of it is just the nature of the medium. You know, as you watch something, as you watch a television show or a movie or anything else, you kind of get sucked in. It's a vicarious experience. I admit I get sucked into characters. Well, here, let me paint a picture for you. And this is from an actual show. And my reaction to this disturbed me at first. And that's why I said that. So imagine you and your friends are at school and you're doing your normal thing, and suddenly an alien invasion occurs and they've decided they want to wipe everybody out. So they're going through and they're bombing the planet with their spaceships and their giant robots and all that stuff. And suddenly you find out that for some strange reason, your school has this super robot hidden somewhere within it.
Okay.
Okay. So, you know, you don't want your friends to get killed or hurt. You don't want, you know, these are the town you live in and a place. So you decide you're going to go try to pilot this thing. And you get in the cockpit and you can't figure out how to turn it on. And there's this message flashing on the screen. And probably at first you don't see it initially because you're pissed and you want to save people. And it says, "Do you renounce your humanity?"
Huh.
And in the show, it took a while, but the kid did it.
Uh-huh.
And my first reaction was, like, because I was sucked into the character a bit, was, oh, yeah, okay. And then I thought, whoa, wait a second.
Mm-hmm.
That ain't right. Now, fortunately, that show wasn't very good, and it didn't do as well as they would like it to. But, I mean, that's kind of the extent you can get to with some of the transhuman things. There's literally a machine saying, if you renounce your humanity, you can use this machine to save people. And as soon as he did it, he was injected with nanobots or something. And, you know, they did all kinds of crazy stuff. So,
and became the hero and saved everybody. And it,
right.
The idea being that you'll identify with the character, and then the idea of giving up your humanity to save humanity.
Yeah. Well, and there's a lot of that. You get into a lot of shows, and maybe we should go into some specifics. But that the name of that show is Valve Grave.
Okay.
And it's a giant robot. The setting is actually a space colony. It's a giant robot show. The robots are cool, but that was one of the more right-in-your-face shows where you go, well, wait a second. So you're telling me that this kid is no longer human and had to do that to basically be the savior of his people. Well, that's messed up. And it's, you know, and to be honest, the way they did his struggle. So he's sitting in the cockpit and he can't figure out how to get this thing to work. And he's not really paying attention. And when he finally sees the message, it isn't even really that much of a struggle for him to make the decision.
Hmm.
That part was the easy part. Getting past his rage to be able to think enough to go, well, why can't I start this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Is where the real struggle took place. That's pretty disturbing. That was one of the ones that really opened my eyes and made me go, now, wait a second, what exactly are they trying to sell here?
Yeah. Well, what are some other examples that you've noticed that maybe some of the more popular or influential shows?
Of the shows that I've watched, and I don't always watch the super popular stuff. I mean, Sailor Moon is very popular, and the idea is, hey, I could be a Sailor Scout, which is what they call themselves, right? Mm-hmm. And I could have superpowers, and I could fight villains and do these things. And, you know, and there isn't a – they aren't really saying you're not human, but you're enhanced in some way. And it's, as I understand it, it's never really been fully explained if it's a science thing or a magic thing or some weird combination thereof. And this was popular for a while. There's a show called Guilty Crown. And I picked it up because it was supposedly this post-apocalyptic thing. And, well, it wasn't exactly what they described it as. But the idea is you had another high school kid, so he's easily identified with more young people.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow gets in the middle of this deal between a rebel group and the military over this retrovirus. He ends up getting it. He's going to go pass it along to somebody because he doesn't really care at the time. Well, due to a stray bullet, he's suddenly infected with it. And this retrovirus gives him the ability to literally pull somebody's soul out of their body and use it as a weapon.
Ugh.
So, you know, but he becomes the hero of the day because he can now do this. And then then you get into, oh, and different souls do different things. And the female character, the female supportive character in this really annoys me because she is painted as this complete waste who's basically almost like a vampire victim who's addicted to this being taken advantage of this way.
Uh-huh.
It's really disturbing.
So he gives the soul back after he uses it as a weapon?
Yeah. When it's used, it returns unless there's some rules. I think if the host dies, it just moves on to whatever it would move on to. But it's not like he takes it permanently. But those people, when you know they don't have a soul in their body, they're just incapacitated. So
bizarre.
Yeah. And that was pretty. That was actually put together by the people who put together Death Note, which I mentioned earlier. So it did get a lot of views. And it's still pretty popular.
Hmm.
Let's see what else I pulled up in my list. That's a good one. Darker Than Black is a series. It's currently owned by Funimation. It was actually on Netflix for a while. I actually really enjoyed this show. This falls more into the supernatural, and the theology is weird. It's not really a demon messing with people. The idea is this event occurred in Tokyo and in other parts of the world where this zone was created. And at the same time that the zone was created, suddenly some people became what they call contractors. And it's not like they had a choice to enter into these contracts, but these contracts come upon them and they get superpowers, but there's a price. So the lead character's contract, which they never explicitly explain, but his contract is every time he uses his power, and his power is, I think, to be able to electrify things, he has to eat massive amounts of food.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these scenes with him going to these noodle shops and eating like 30 bowls of ramen.
That's kind of funny. Yeah, but that's your typical college kid,
right?
Here in the U.S.
But these, yeah. You know, there's kind of what you would call good contractors and bad contractors, and it gets really weird. On nobody really knows where the powers came from or where why these events happened, or, you know, was it supernatural? Was some kind of weird science thing? All the stars disappeared when this happened, and now everyone is represented. Every one of the contractors is represented by a star in the sky.
Interesting.
And so when, you know, a contractor is killed, a star falls out of the sky. It's weird, and it kind of gets back to that idea of, well, you know, the normal people, and there actually are normal people who are main characters in that, the police officers and some other things, who are trying to control these contractors, and they're not totally helpless against them, but, you know, they're up against a lot to face off against them. Mm-hmm. So And the hero's not, it's kind of an anti-hero story. So the hero's kind of a villain, kind of a hero all at the same time. But again, you're into this idea that, well, these people were enhanced somehow. And it was, in a lot of cases, it's everyday people. You know, it's not like, okay, Superman who came from another planet and was exposed to our sun and suddenly had superpowers. Mm-hmm. You know?
So, yeah, like a giant supernatural portal or something opens up is something more along those lines instead of...
Yeah, kind of. They never really explained the event very well. It's like a portal opened up and it kind of messed up an area and then all these weird things started happening. And that was in the anime. I haven't actually read the manga. What happens a lot in Japan is they take the comic books that somebody wrote and they say, hey, this is a good story. Let's turn it into an animated series. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes you get a lot more story in the comic books and they explain a lot more stuff. Mm. Because they kind of condense stuff over there. A season of television is 12 episodes. A lot of shows will run two seasons. That's pretty typical. But a lot of them now, actually, it's becoming more popular to just run 12 episodes and cram all your story into 12 episodes.
Instead of turning into a long-running series.
Right. Yeah. Now, there are long-running series. There's popular shows like Bleach, which is people with supernatural powers fighting supernatural demons. I haven't actually watched very much of Bleach. It's not really my thing. One Piece, which is about pirates fighting each other and fighting other people. People who like it, who watch it, love it. Hmm. And it's been on, I think it's on season 10 or something like that. Hmm. But there are long-running shows. They're just, they have a better concept of the idea of a story arc over there. Whereas, you know, here, like Lost is a really good example of this. I think the original, you know, originally when they started the idea of Lost, they had an idea where they were going. Mm-hmm. But then they figured out, wait, it's making money. People are watching it. How can we stretch this out?
Well, and they had some other issues that popped up in the middle. There was a writer's strike that shortened one of the seasons. And then you had the character, the guy who played the character of Mr. Echo decided he didn't want to go back to work in Hawaii. So they had to kill him off. And
right.
Yeah, unexpected things. By the time they got to the end, it was like, what?
Right. But oftentimes the entire, you know, when they go to put something on the air, the entire show's done.
Yeah. Well, and that, so. And that is good storytelling. And it allows for a more cohesive message, I suppose, to be transmitted or communicated to the viewer. Just from your position as a fan, again, and looking at a number of these different different types of series, how do you see the style influencing the viewpoint of fans? And I'll preface this to maybe clarify what I mean a little bit. As a geek from way back, I was very much, even at a young age, influenced by Star Trek, which it came out before I was really old enough to understand it. It was 65, 66, and I was born in 62. But, it hit reruns almost right away. So by the time I was in the first grade, I was able to do the Mr. Spock one eyebrow thing. And that future seemed to me to be the way mankind ought to go. You know, even though I was going to church every Sunday, folks took me to church, was in Sunday school every week, sitting there in church, listening to the pastor's sermons every Sunday. And it wasn't until adulthood and getting through a series of life things, spiritual board to the head, that I began to realize, wait a minute. There are implications to accepting the theory of Darwinian evolution. You know, the theory of evolution by natural selection is not, you cannot syncretize that with biblical Christianity. It isn't possible. There has to be an original fall, a fall from grace, an original sin. So things like that, it began to force me to rethink my worldview. But for a long time, the hard science fiction that I read, authors like Niven and Asimov and Heinlein, were very influential to my worldview, even though I was in church every Sunday morning.
Right.
Because I identified with the characters in those stories. I thought that was really cool. I thought, Star Trek, especially Next Generation, I really like that. Thought, hey, that is really where mankind is going to be. What a glorious future once we develop the technology to overcome hunger and poverty, and we get past the ignorance of blind religious faith that leads to all these wars, which I know now is not true.
Right.
But, you know, how do you see those ideas of in anime influencing people who are maybe at the age I was then when I was open to those ideas? How do you see these manifesting in going forward?
One of the things that's very popular in the anime world is cosplay, which is basically putting on costumes of your favorite characters and emulating them in some respects. One of the things that's become popular now is the idea of doing a panel. So like at a convention, you'll talk about things at a panel and doing that in character. And, you know, so they'll do a Q&A in character from certain shows. It's an interesting idea, but the more people immerse themselves, and I've seen this with people who are really into cosplay, the more, and there's a healthy point and there's an unhealthy point. It's like anything else. Mm-hmm. The people who get a little too into it are obviously highly influenced by that character, and they really start to truly identify with that character. So if it's somebody who has superpowers, well, they're going to be longing for superpowers. A lot of the, you know, in terms of where things are going, it's not as cut and dry in the anime community because there's such variety in things. But a lot of, at least from the science fiction perspective, is a lot of push towards, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I could get a shot and suddenly I would be able to do this awesome thing? Would adjust my DNA in some way that I could now have psychic powers or shoot energy blasts from my hands or transform into a magical girl or something like that. Or wouldn't it be cool if I had a giant robot? I freely admit it would be cool if I had a giant robot.
Yeah,
but,
I agree.
You know, but again, you look at the show Valvrave and, oh, look, there was a price to getting that giant robot. You know, oftentimes the price is overlooked, and I think that's because at the end of it all, most of it has a pretty Darwinian view. They don't really come out and say that so much, but it's there. So they don't necessarily value life the way we do. You know, we look at life as being something God gave us. We were created in God's image, therefore we intrinsically have value.
Right.
You know, Darwinianism or whatever term you want to use for it, evolution, doesn't really say that because it's survival of the fittest. Well, if you're not the fittest, if you're not adding to society, if you're not productive, you're not of value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this gets back to the show I mentioned closer to the start of the thing called Psychopaths, which I highly recommend because it's a great story. But there's some really interesting transhumanist thoughts in there. And it's set in a dystopian future where they have figured out a way to measure what they call your aura. And it's not an aura like we think of it in magical terms or that kind of thing. It's more a way they figured out how to measure your crime potential.
Okay. Department of Pre-Crime.
Yeah. And they weed people out in advance and just put them in prison or even go as far as to get rid of them. And I don't want to say too much more for those who might actually go check it out because it is a good show and I would spoil a lot for you.
No.
But, you know, that's the future. And a lot of people I've met, although that isn't as popular a show as it should be for terms of the storytelling, but a lot of the people I've met in the anime communities do look to science as being, oh, they're going to create the utopia and they're going to create all this cool stuff for us. Okay, probably not. Mm-hmm. It might blow up in your face. And there's just as many cautionary tales, just like there are a lot of cautionary tales in science fiction as well. A lot of alien invasion stuff is a cautionary tale. You know,
right.
Don't do that. That would be bad. So,
but interestingly, even in the science fiction community, where we've got all kinds of examples of technology and transhumanism gone bad, as in the Borg from Star Trek, or the Cybermen from Doctor Who, or the Terminator from the Terminator films. still, there is a very active and, shall we say, passionate transhumanist community, which I suppose, given the presupposition that many of them have, that there is no God, so there is no afterlife unless they can create one through technology,
right.
Their worldview makes a lot of sense. And since, there's a song that I heard once, and it's not really an old song. Somebody wrote it as a joke, but it's based on the old line, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Right.
That's, you can understand if you believe that there is nothing after your last breath, you can understand the passion with which the transhumanists pursue mm-hmm. eternal life through technology. But, and again, if our kids and our grandkids aren't raised with an understanding, say, hey, look, you're already a transhuman, okay? You
right.
are going to be a posthuman someday. The question you need to answer is where you spend eternity, what your
right.
final address is going to be. And if they don't get that, then the message is that, let's see, I could wind up inside a giant robot. I could wind up as an information pattern in a mainframe someplace.
Right.
I could spend eternity as frozen in stasis until somebody can thaw me out and cure me of my incurable disease, whatever. Those ideas will have a lot of appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And while we present these ideas to people around us in our congregations, most folks who are in church on Sunday mornings think these ideas are pretty crazy.
Right.
But those minds that are open to these ideas because they've been exposed to it through their entertainment, their favorite form of entertainment, as we sit them in front of the electronic babysitter, whether it's television or now, tablet or laptop or whatever, iPod even, they, have been seeing this idea and absorbing these concepts from a very early age. How young are some of these anime productions aimed? How young are they geared?
They go all the way down to preschool.
Okay.
Now, admittingly, you get down to that level and it's, cats and dogs and stuff like that. It's really similar to the really young stuff you get over here.
Sure, sure.
It's not as – and I haven't really watched a lot of that because, it's really geared for really young kids.
Yeah.
But the teens and preteens is where they're really going to start picking up stuff. That's mm-hmm. where there's a lot of focus on the shows. It's where you get into a lot of these ideas kind of being planted and being explored,
mm-hmm.
You mentioned like the Cybermen and the Terminator and all that, but what's interesting is they're never presented as transhuman, even though we know they are. Mm-hmm. Cybermen were men once.
Right. You will be upgraded or you will be deleted. Yeah.
Right. The Terminator, it could be a personality uploaded, but it's that kind of concept.
Right. No, that's just the artificial superintelligence that decided to go rogue. That's not really a transhuman. Right.
Right. But I mean, these ideas are rarely presented that way, and it's rarely presented in anime or in American stuff. It's rarely presented as this choice of you can be human or you can not be human. It's always either presented as an upgrade, if it's even presented like that at all, or there's never the rare occasion like the Valve Rave show where it actually says you give up your humanity to do this. That's the rare exception. But at that point, you're so involved in the story and the hero, and you want to be able to save all your friends and save everything. Well, yeah, if that's the price, I'm going to do it, which again gets back to the lack of value of humanity. Which is where all this gets back to.
Yeah, and as Christians, that's something that we really can't negotiate away.
Right.
Yeah. You recommended the program Psychopaths. Are there others that you recommend that are good examples of these ideas that we can check out?
That you can get easily?
Yeah.
Say
Netflix or somewhere on the web.
Legally on the web, if you want to spend the money. Oh, actually, Crunchyroll you can watch. You just don't get the simulcast as fast. You can watch that for free. There's a lot of shows on there. I'm going to quickly look at what's on Netflix. Psychopaths just recently hit Netflix, so that one's available. I would recommend. It definitely gets into these ideas. There's a whole sequence about the idea of people being uploaded into machines that plays a role in it. And I don't have the quotes in front of me. I wish I had written them down, but some of the things the guy says are amazing in terms of selling this idea. Knights of Cydonia, which is on Netflix as well. And it's set kind of out in space. Earth has been destroyed by this weird alien. And basically for humanity to survive, we had to re-engineer them. And that's another theme you get a lot. Oh, well, for humanity to survive, we had to re-engineer them into the new humanity to be able to face this challenge or that challenge.
That's
because they weren't good enough as they were.
That's interesting. And that is a theme that you see in the transhumanist movement as well. They consider it a matter of humanity's survival.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's also both of these that I've mentioned so far are examples of excellent storytelling.
Okay.
And that's part of where they get their power, because they are telling these stories so well. You know, it's a lot easier to ignore something when it's being told horribly.
Yeah. And, you know, and although to give another example, use Dan Brown for another example, he's been criticized for shallow characters and, you know, rather lackluster writing ability. But the fact is, he does tell a pretty good story. And if he didn't, he wouldn't have sold millions of copies of The Da Vinci Code or The Lost Symbol, and would not have drawn so many people to places like Roslyn Chapel to, you know, try to decipher the strange markings in the old building there. And again, the exciting story draws you in. Even like the Raiders of the Lost Ark films.
Oh yeah.
You know. Oh, did they really find the Lost Ark in Egypt? Maybe it really is there. Oh, maybe there really is something about the Holy Grail there at Petra. And what about those crystal skulls? Aren't those, you know, maybe there really is some special power to those things? Mm-hmm. No, not really. And if you'd watched it on a documentary film or read a nonfiction book or a book purportedly nonfiction, you probably wouldn't have bought into the idea so easily there.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I often look back and go, you know, the Bible is full of stories, and it's full of stories for a reason, because when we read a story, we retain more from that story.
Yes. Yes.
And the enemy has figured out how to use that to his advantage.
Yeah.
And that's why we have the Hollywood we have. So if you're going to watch any of these things, and, you know, I'm probably not as careful as I need to be sometimes, but you got to use some discernment as you're watching them and say, hey, wait, let's think about this, because the characters are compelling and the storylines are really good. And if you're a smart person, and I'm sure everybody in the audience of this show is a smart person, you're going to be fed in a way that you have not been by American entertainment, in the sense of, wow, they're actually exploring some interesting ideas. They're not just throwing something up and then sharks come out of a tornado. You know,
as highbrow as that is, you won't typically find that. Now, to be fair, Japan did give us the guys, you know, the giant monster with the guy in a rubber suit. So,
well, yeah, but let's be fair about the first Godzilla film. The first Godzilla film was supposed to be this, you know, thing about what tampering with nature and nuclear weapons.
Right, right.
You know, and
eventually
then they kind of got silly after that.
Yeah, it turned into a Gaia worship type movement. Oh, we're hurting Mother Earth, and, you know, so she's sending these monsters to tell us to quit poisoning her.
Exactly.
Yeah. Taylor, Taylor Kent is a social critic. Is that a fair...
That's a fair comment.
Yeah. Again, the lamented and on hiatus podcast, Snark Tank Productions, the archive still available at thesnarkyavenger.com. Mm-hmm. And a good friend, Taylor, we appreciate just taking the hour to just kind of kick around these ideas, and look forward to wherever your creative abilities and desires take you next.
Yep. I will definitely keep you guys informed, and I look forward to being on the show again.
Look to the show notes at vftb.net for a link to Snark Infested Waters and Snark Tank Productions. Our good friend Taylor Kent, it was good to see him and Chris out in Colorado Springs for the Pikes Peak Prophecy Summit, and we appreciate his perspective on the world. He is part of a community that maybe I'm just a little bit too old to have become a part of when anime first began to make a big splash here in the U.S. I guess I caught some of the early days with Speed Racer, which was one of the cartoons I watched every day coming home from school. But never my interest in anime really never extended beyond Speed Racer. So, but it is popular. And as we discussed, and the reason that I think this was worth an episode and perhaps more going forward is because of the influence that fiction has on our belief systems as a culture, as people. It is a bit depressing to know how influential works of fiction, books, movies, video games, etc., are on the theology of the average person on the street. So we need to understand what lies the enemy is selling through pop culture if we hope to address them in any meaningful way. So we'll continue this discussion and perhaps circle back around to this topic at some point in the future. Transhumanism, in my view and Sharon's view, one of the reasons we're working on a book, working title Rise of the Cyber Gods, is because this is such an appealing false eschatology. For a sci-fi geek like myself, had I not been led by the Holy Spirit to investigate the truth claims of Christianity, apologetics, how do we know that the documents in the Bible are actually true and haven't been revised every couple hundred years to serve the whims of this king or that? Had I not been led through that process, the Star Trek future would have been really, really appealing to me. I mean, I devoured hard science fiction as a high school student. Authors like Niven and Heinlein and Bradbury and so forth, and of course Roddenberry with Star Trek. Very influential, a very appealing future. And for a kid who was not really part of the mainstream of social life through school, the escape to the world of science fiction was a way to forget about the fact that I was not one of the cool kids. But there was maybe an appeal to some intellectual pride. And I think that's what really appeals to those in the transhumanist movement. They want to think that they are smart enough to actually lead the transformation from humanity into virtual godhood. So again, this is a topic we will continue to visit in the years ahead, because it is only now beginning to register on the radar of rank and file Christians. There are a few out there who've been sounding an early warning, but again, most folks in the pews on Sunday mornings don't even know what the word means. One of the drawbacks of trying to work ahead in producing this program as I do, which I have to do because I try to do this around a full-time work schedule and commitments to other organizations or church, a couple of singing groups that I belong to, and the organization to which the singing group belongs to, is that it makes it difficult to respond or produce a program that can respond in a very timely manner to issues in the news, which is why I kind of add these comments at the end of the program. But it's why we don't do full-length programs on things like the trouble in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri. Just to recap briefly, if you haven't watched the news or paid attention, last Saturday, August 9th, 2014, just after 12 noon Central Time, an 18-year-old black man named Michael Brown, who was unarmed, was shot and killed by a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri. Michael was African American. The story told by Michael's friend was that he was accosted by the officer while walking in the street instead of on the sidewalk. The officer attempted, according to Brown's friend, tried to pull him into the police car, grabbed him by the throat, tried to pull him into the police car, after which a tussle ensued. Brown broke free and ran and was shot. He then stopped, put his hands up, and attempted to surrender, at which point the officer shot several more times and killed him. This resulted in protests that turned violent in Ferguson, but also in other areas around St. Louis County, nowhere near Ferguson. There were incidents at the Galleria, which is a very upscale mall in the center of St. Louis County, miles away from Ferguson. Another episode where a stretch of Interstate 270 in North St. Louis County had to be shut down because teenagers were chucking bricks onto the highway. And you don't want to encounter a brick at 65 miles an hour. That can be deadly. Streets in North County had to be closed around the Jamestown Mall, which is north and east of Ferguson, again, miles away from where the incident took place. The community of Ferguson is in kind of a densely populated area of St. Louis County. It's pretty much urban from Ferguson all the way into St. Louis proper. About 70% of the community is African-American, but almost all of the police officers on the police force are white. That was a source of the anger that erupted. Unfortunately, within a very short period of time, agents provocateur from outside the community arrived, and I believe that is why St. Louis County experienced several nights of violence, which wasn't handled well, in my opinion. And I'm not an expert here, but in my opinion, the response of the police force, Ferguson and then St. Louis County, which deployed officers from all over the county, was rather heavy-handed. It turns out there's a program that's been going on since the late 90s through which the Department of Defense and the Department of Homeland Security will take surplus equipment that is being pulled out of use for the military and is then distributed to police departments across the country. And so we saw images, video and still images of police officers responding to the violent protests and the looting taking place in and around Ferguson, Missouri, equipped and dressed as though they were soldiers in a war zone. There was one veteran of the Iraq War who commented that the police officers were equipped with more equipment than they used when they went into hot zones in Iraq. So this did nothing to calm the situation, but was like pouring gasoline on the flames. Governor of Missouri eventually ordered the Ferguson Police Department to stand down, deployed the Missouri State Police, and things were quiet there Thursday night this past week, but then Friday night things blew up again, and I understand there was some violence again last night, Saturday the 16th. So it was a difficult week for a couple of reasons. First of all, the incident itself, there are different stories that have come out, and the racial tension that has existed in the St. Louis area, North St. Louis County, which is not unique to St. Louis, although sadly media folk from outside the area like to point to the St. Louis area as somehow being more racist than others. And I can speak to this with some experience since we lived in St. Louis. I lived in St. Louis for about 16 years until 2006, and we still live within a couple hours of it. Our daughter still lives in St. Louis. So we have connections, friends there, and we have an understanding to some extent of what life is like in St. Louis County. When I first moved there in the late 90s, I lived not far from where the shooting took place, a couple of miles, Hazelwood. Attended church in Ferguson. So again, I'm somewhat familiar with the area. And on a recent trip to St. Louis, I actually drove through Ferguson. There's some very old homes, century homes, along Elizabeth Avenue there in Ferguson, Old Town Ferguson, very charming place. So it's a racially diverse mix, but the combination of an unarmed teenager being shot down by a white police officer combined with the response of the police to the initial protests, dressed for battle, didn't help things. And then the arrival of the outside agents provocateur. It took all of 72 hours for Al Sharpton to show up on the scene. He preached a sermon today, the 17th of August, at a church in Ferguson. He's never one to shy about jumping out in front of a parade. Let's put it that way. On the other side of the coin, you've got those who are just angry about the militarization of the police. Alex Jones made this a number one topic on his program this past week. And our daughter said, interestingly enough, it was kind of a valuable resource, the live feed that associates of Jones. Alex didn't actually show up with his bullhorn, but assistants were actually providing a live feed and giving him reports. So she said the live feed was actually useful for getting an idea of what was happening near the site of the shooting. But sadly, the looting that took place elsewhere around the county created a problem, I think, for those who would like to see justice done. Because while we feel for the parents in the loss of their son and would like to see justice done, if an investigation shows conclusively that the officer was in the wrong in shooting a young man who was trying to surrender to him, then he should be prosecuted. The officer should be prosecuted. However, there are those who will say that that's not enough and they want blood. Then there are the opportunists who were looting and using social media to coordinate these flash mobs at places nowhere near Ferguson, like the Galleria. There was a rumor that there was something starting over in St. Charles, which is on the other side of the Missouri River. Jamestown Mall. These sites were nowhere near Ferguson, had nothing to do with the incident, but were just opportunities for vandals, thieves, thugs to grab some free stuff. And as usually happens in cases like this, it was the people in the community of Ferguson who were actually suffering the most from the looting. Yeah, look, and that makes no sense at all. And what it does is it puts to the lie, it proves the lie that the violence was somehow a protest over the shooting of Michael Brown. I mean, if you're upset at the way your community is being policed, why do you go and trash your community? Trash those who are trying to bring some commerce into the community. It makes no sense. Well, it does, but only if you assume that the reasons that are being given for the violence are a lie. So, and it makes it difficult for people who live in that area who want justice done and just want things to restored to order. It makes it difficult for them to empathize with the parents who have lost a child, because they're seeing their communities being trashed in response to what was supposedly an unjust act. And they're suffering. The economy of the area is suffering because of looting that's taking place. And because of the dynamic, later in the week, the police backed way off and basically allowed the looters to have free run of a number of stores that had been rifled through and looted a couple of times already, so that they wouldn't make things worse by firing a weapon at another young black man. So what do we do as Christian? Oh, and here's the other thing that's come out this week. In fact, this just came out today. A cell phone video is making its way around the web. And according to the last time I looked at the website where you can find this, and I'll put a link to this in the show notes as well, this particular video now has about 3.4 million views. So this is spreading around the web pretty quickly. A cell phone video taken minutes after Brown was shot, and you can see in the cell phone video the young man lying in the street, dead. And you hear in the background commentary from somebody who saw the shooting, and his story is different from the one that's being told by the friend of Michael Brown. According to the witness who's caught on this cell phone camera, Brown had turned and was bull rushing the officer. And so if that is in fact the case, and I understand that Attorney General Eric Holder has launched or ordered a federal autopsy on the body of Michael Brown, if it is in fact the case that Brown was shot as he was charging the officer rather than running away from the officer, that may put a whole new spin on the story and on the investigation into the officer who's been identified as Darren Wilson, lived in Southwest St. Louis County. So, sadly, this event has become bigger than what it originally was. Confrontation that turned into a tragic loss of life, a senseless loss of life. In fact, the officer who stopped Brown was not aware that Brown was apparently wanted for a strong-arm robbery that had taken place about 5 minutes earlier at a convenience store just around the corner from where he was shot. And if you do a Google search on this, you can find this on the web, too, the security footage from the security camera at the convenience store showing Brown manhandling the owner of the convenience store and walking out of the store with a $50 box of cigars. Was released by the police in Ferguson on Friday. And that was what Al Sharpton was so angry about in his sermon delivered today at a church in the St. Louis area, that the police were trying to besmirch young Mr. Brown. Well, so, you know, this has become an episode that has blown way out of proportion because, again, there are vested interests on both sides, Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and others who are openly calling for violence. Apparently, the new Black Panthers arrived in town within about 24 hours of the incident and started calling for violence against the police. And on the other side, you've got patriots and the patriot movement angry about the militarization of police, which is unquestionably a disturbing trend. Also trying to use this incident to further their own agenda. How do we as Christians respond to this? I've got to admit, I'm conflicted over this because the video footage from the convenience store appears to show this young man, who's a pretty big kid, at least compared to the clerk at the convenience store who tried to stop him from getting out the door, basically manhandling and threatening this guy over a box of cigars. And if the witness on this cell phone cam is correct, and the kid turned and was running toward the police officer after apparently trying to, according to the police officer, grab his gun, reach inside the police car and tried to grab the officer's gun, then how do we feel about that? I don't know. I mean, if the kid was running toward the officer, it doesn't necessarily mean that the officer handled the situation entirely correctly, but it does put things in a different light than the story that was being given to us. And I've already extended this program by about 20 minutes by going on about this topic, but this is something that, we're 2 hours away from St. Louis, and this is something that is big news here in this part of the country. It is getting a lot of attention from national news media, but as always happens when national media converges on a place, they really don't know the ground, and they don't know the people who live there. They don't really know the situation. And then you've got the iconic figures like Jackson and Sharpton and Jones and others who arrive to take the situation and use it for their own ends. And so there are people all over the country with opinions about what happened who don't really know what's going on. And frankly, I'm in that category. All I can report on, all I can use to analyze and inform my views is what I'm seeing in the media. And as I learned early on in my media career, when I was in college as an intern at a news intern for a radio station in Chicago, learned very early that when I went home from covering a news event and looked at different media outlets, newspapers, radio, TV stations, I would sometimes wonder if they had really been at the reporters had been at the same event that I had seen, because they came away with a completely different spin on the story. So that's a lesson I've carried with me for 35 years. And that's something we should keep in mind as we try to make sense out of this story. This kid shouldn't have died last week, Saturday. But there are multiple reasons that he did. One, that he didn't listen to a police officer. Two, perhaps the police officer didn't respond correctly. Perhaps there are things that this young man should have learned about how to get along in the world as a child that led to his behavior on Saturday, August 9th, that culminated in death by gunshot. Again, this is one of those things. I just don't know what to make of it. But it certainly puts an exclamation point on the understanding that this world, at least for now, is still the domain of the prince of this world, the God of this world, to which we say, come quickly, Lord Jesus. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, August 20th, this coming Wednesday, we talk with Dr. Ken Johnson. Well, we talked with him at the Pikes Peak Prophecy Summit and discussed his presentation, rather controversial, on the Gnostic origins of Calvinism and Catholicism. You hear what that's about on Wednesday night. The next Sunday evening, had a great conversation with Chris White of Bible Prophecy Talk, Nowhere to Run, excellent podcasts, and the man who coordinates all of the feeds into one big podcast feed at Revelations Radio Network, Chris White. He will discuss his new book, False Christ. Will the Antichrist present himself as the Jewish Messiah? Will he present himself to the world as a Jew? He'll discuss the evidence for that, and that will be uploaded next Sunday evening at vftb.net. On the 27th, another interview from Pikes Peak, Billy Crone, a young man who pastors a church out in Las Vegas, Nevada, and has a very interesting story to tell. And then on August 31st, I'm going to upload a program, an interview conducted this past Friday morning with a fellow from England about the biblical church. This is prompted by a CD set that was given to me by some friends, Phil and Jeanette, out in the Canton, Ohio area, friends of Rest Isdars there, about the traditions of the elders, the early church fathers, and before them, the traditions of the Jewish elders, and how the teachings that the Lord passed down through the prophets and then from Jesus to the apostles has been transformed into something else by man-made traditions. That's an interesting discussion, and his teachings on it are, well, they kind of shake your paradigm just a little bit. So that's what's coming up on A View from the Bunker, which is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. And as always, and sometimes we see very plainly that we're wrestling not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.